Hi, I'm Brian Summers, and I write the Airline Observer.
And I'm Brett Snyder, and you probably know me as the author of Cranky Flyer. You're listening to The Air Show, the podcast where we talk about what goes on in the business of the sky.
Thank you to everyone who got in touch with us after our debut episode last week. It was great to hear from all of you, and some of you sent some suggestions and encouragement, so we appreciate that. Remember, you can contact us on our website, theairshowpodcast.com.
So, Brian, John is at the aerospace event today, but we'll see if we can get him to drop in a little bit later. But for now, it's just me and you. We're hosting this podcast. What are we talking about today?
Well, first of all, I hope John is enjoying talking about metal. But you and I are going to talk about some commercial issues today. Today's topic is JetBlue. So we're going to try to answer this question. Has the team in Long Island City figured out what it's doing?
Yes, yet? We're done.
Now, I think a lot of our listeners, Brett, maybe not all of them, but know that both of us have been extremely critical of JetBlue, especially recently. There's some good reasons for that. One of them is that the airline has made some very boneheaded decisions, but I also think it's because of where we live. You're in Long Beach, California. I'm in Los Angeles. And no matter what the people on the East Coast think, this is an East Coast-centric brand. And JetBlue has tried so hard over the years to make its brand resonate in California, first in Long Beach, and more recently in LA. It just hasn't worked. And I think that's why we just don't have these warm, fuzzy feelings about JetBlue, right?
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, look, I do live in Long Beach. And so JetBlue for years was our hometown airline here in a sense. But it never really caught on beyond the immediate area, especially after Virgin America started flying LAX, New York, and Boston, and people said, oh, I don't have to go to Long Beach anymore if they lived further away. And JetBlue tried a whole bunch of different things, and now they've apparently given up based on the news this week that, as I'm calling it in a post I'm working on, LA becomes a spoke on steroids, I suppose. But it is a very different story if you're on the East Coast, if you're in Boston, New York, Florida. It's obviously a very different airline, and that's probably where it should be focused. And really, that's what we've heard lately. New CEO, Joanna Garrity, taking over for Robin Hayes, and then bringing Marty St. George in as president. And they've been saying some of the right things, which is, we're going to focus on our strengths.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the problem, right? If you only have so many airplanes, they all should have been in those East Coast focus cities that are so important to the airline. Everything that they were doing in LA, especially recently, it didn't work. And you had markets like Boston, where JetBlue seems to have lost focus, and Delta went in and poached some of its customers. And I believe Delta now flies more ASMs in Boston than JetBlue.
Yeah, ASMs are cheating a little because they do a lot of long haul now. But either way, I mean, this year they're passing JetBlue in almost every metric. And they had already been above JetBlue, and I think it was in the summer, if I remember right. But it's more the difference. I mean, JetBlue had a significant and healthy lead going into the pandemic. And then during the pandemic, it just sort of gave it away. And Delta said, well, we're going to invest in this place. And it's done pretty well for itself in Boston.
Yeah, I don't want to be too Los Angeles focused, but of course, there's a lot of media out there that are very interested in New York. And I was reminded of something this week because Seth Miller, really good aerospace aviation journalist, posted it. This idea, you know, JetBlue wanted to start with 35 daily departures from Los Angeles, but they had made this infographic in 2020 that they actually wanted to go up to 70 departures by 2025. And, you know, that's a weird place for an airline to be, right? Because you have a bunch of airlines that have more than 100 departures in LA. You have a bunch of airlines that call LA a focus city or a hub city. What was 70 departures in LA going to do for them?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, this was part of the Spirit merger plan was, hey, we're going to basically be able to take over a whole terminal here. But it wasn't just LA. It was Dallas and Detroit and wherever else Spirit had a big enough presence. They thought they were going to be able to do something magical, but it still would have kept them as a tweener. And I don't know what you do with those extra flights in a place like LA where you're fighting for sixth place. It's a tough place to be. But Brian, let's kind of back off just LA for a second. Let's go bigger picture. You were paying close attention to the JP Morgan Industrials Conference last week, right?
I was.
So, I mean, what was your takeaway from that, from the presentation there that Joanna gave?
Yeah, my takeaway was that even though Joanna Garrity was the president and COO of JetBlue during this whole period of bad expansion, bad ideas, ideas that the Justice Department didn't like, Joanna Garrity is coming out and saying to Wall Street, a lot of those bad ideas, those belong to my predecessor, Robin Hayes. This is a new JetBlue. I've hired a new president, Marty St. George, who was let go from JetBlue or retired from JetBlue.
I like to say he was disappeared.
He was disappeared. He went down to South America.
Well, first he went to Norway, then he went to South America. Let's be clear here.
JetBlue is going to focus on its strengths right now. And, you know, I had written a post a few weeks ago that said Joanna Garrity should blame every bad decision that was ever made at that place on Robin Hayes, you know, which sounds a bit of like a joke, but that's a communication strategy. And I noticed that she was doing it a little bit. So Jamie Baker at JP Morgan asked Garrity, you know, what's the plan for Europe? And she was cordial. She wasn't mean about it or anything, but she said, you know, that was a Robin idea. It's kind of played out. We're now flying to the key business markets of Amsterdam, London, Paris. That's enough. And so she told the crowd there that future European expansion might be seasonal, like they're doing with Dublin right now, a chance to use airplanes, A321neos, at times of the year where maybe it doesn't work in the transcon market, things like that. So we're going to see a little less Europe growth, we think. We're going to see, we've already seen it, but closing stations that don't work for JetBlue. So one of them that's going away is Baltimore. There were some others that were announced this week. You know, JetBlue told a story. I mean, I guess you tell us whatever story you need to that makes your strategy make sense. But they said that we're going to keep a lot of these routes open if we are able to merge with Spirit. And all of a sudden, in a market like LA or Baltimore, we were going to be, you know, roughly twice the size or more than that. And so we didn't want to give up routes that don't work today but might work in the future. And then they also talked a little bit about aircraft. They're not going to be growing much at all. They're having their Pratt & Whitney engine troubles. And then they've also deferred lots of aircraft. So it's all about back to basics at JetBlue. And I think you'll agree with me, Brett, that this couldn't come soon enough.
Oh, yeah. This should have happened long ago. I don't understand what Robin was doing the last 5 years. I know that sounds, I don't know, maybe flippant or something, but really, I'm just not sold on the European thing. But that was his big thing that he had to show for it. The Spirit merger, I don't understand how you think that going from 35 to 70 flights or whatever it might be all of a sudden makes you relevant. Where do you put those flights? I mean, if you're in a Dallas, you know, Spirit is the low-cost operator at DFW. I mean, Frontier is too. But, you know, you have American, this behemoth that is American. Where do you point those airplanes if you're JetBlue going for this more premium leisure type of traveler that you think you can really make a killing in a place like Dallas or even Detroit or any of these places? I never understood the strategy. And I'm glad that it's dead. And now there's a lot of cleanup they have to do because they spent so much time on either pet projects or these wild fantasies like Spirit or the Northeast Alliance with American, which I actually didn't hate. But, you know, now that those are all dead, like, oh, wait, we forgot to take care of the actual core airline. Maybe we should do that now.
Yeah, Brett, I'm not as crazy about the Northeast Alliance or the Spirit merger. And neither was the Justice Department. I'll defend Europe a little bit more because, you know, when JetBlue was on its game, I don't know, 8 years ago, and you would talk to maybe Marty St. George about the Boston market, the idea was we have a lot of corporate customers there. We own the market. We're the number one airline. You have the top routes where people in Boston want to go. One of them is clearly London. And you have to fly everywhere your customers want to go. Alaska has done that in Seattle. I think there's a pretty true rumor out there, right, Brett, that one of the reasons Alaska probably wants Hawaiian is to put some wide bodies in Seattle to fly to important business markets globally to compete with Delta. So the idea that you're flying a 321 to London from Boston, I don't think on its face is such a bad idea, but the way this thing was rolled out, I didn't care for. And one other thing that I've written about, because I do write about communication sometimes, I didn't like this thing that Robin did over the last 3 or 4 years that I pretty much called whining. It was like, the big four won't let us do this. We can't get into Amsterdam. We can't get slots at London. We can't get gates in Los Angeles. They're all ganging up against us. It's just business, Brett. This is how things work.
Well, sure. Of course it is. But, you know, sometimes that's a strategy that can end up paying dividends.
So, Brett, put on your network planning hat. Where would you have been flying instead of Europe?
Well, okay. First of all, Boston, Boston, Boston. Because you had dominance there. You were the airline. The goal of any airline, if you can have a defensible position as the number one airline, you want that. And Boston was their chance. But they took their eye off the ball over the last few years and let Delta back into the game there. They could have done more with that, and that's where I would have put airplanes. The other thing that goes with that, though, that's interesting is the Northeast Alliance. I like the Northeast Alliance. I mean, it's sort of a, well...
What's not to like? The problem was it was illegal.
Well, I mean, sure. But by the way, you could do something similar to Alaska now. They were told they could do that to the Northwest Alliance, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, they could still do another deal with American for the international. But if you're JetBlue and American, sure, try and give that a swing because you create the third competitor. Obviously, legally, it didn't work for them. But there was one big downside to that. And the big downside was that American said, here, JetBlue, here's a bunch of LaGuardia slots we don't know what to do with. You fly them. And so JetBlue had to actually pull a lot of fleet into New York to service that. And we've seen them start unwinding more and more of that. But, you know, that also took away from Boston. So that was the one downside of the Northeast Alliance for me was that it further took the focus off Boston. But to me, I would have put everything in Boston because that is where you have your best opportunity to create your defensible home. And then, you know, Florida, like Fort Lauderdale, I like sort of the counter-cyclical Latin America traffic. It can be a good way to flow airplanes, summer, winter, put them in different places. You know, I think there probably is more opportunity in a place like Fort Lauderdale to compete against Spirit, where Spirit really is just bottom of the barrel pricing, and there's nobody else really trying to fill that void, you know, for the premium leisure, which definitely exists in South Florida. A lot of VFR traffic down into the Caribbean, things like that. I don't dislike that. Orlando's a different story. That's just, right now, obviously, way overserved. But if you think about Boston and Fort Lauderdale, and then, of course, New York, you won't be able to dominate New York. But, you know, that's your home, and there's real opportunity, and it's highly constrained. And those are the places I'd focus. You know, you hear people say, oh, they need a Midwestern hub. Like, no, they don't. They don't need any of this stuff. There's no reason to just find some ridiculous, well, it's not a ridiculous city, but, you know, a place in the middle just because it'll look pretty on a route map. And I never understood that, why people are like, oh, well, you need it. You need it. No, no, you don't. Focus on your East Coast, Eastern Seaboard. Where do they need to go? Go where they want you to go.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit later about brand and product, because I think those things are important as well as the network. But
hold on, Brian. Let's not wait any longer. I think, you know, network has been talked to death here. We don't need to get into that. Let's talk more about brand and positioning, because I think that is really important. So let's do it now.
Yeah, if there's one thing that concerns me about the plan that executives have outlined to go forward, it's that JetBlue now wants to be all things to all people. So Joanna Garrity has spoken about the fact that they have like gaps in their offering to consumers between the very high end of the Mint cabin and the low end of basic economy. And they want to be all things to all people. And that's something that United executives have talked about recently. But United is a lot bigger of an airline that needs to carry everyone. If you go back, you know, a quarter of a century now, which is amazing, and you think about how JetBlue started, the whole idea was to bring humanity back to air travel, right? It wasn't supposed to be an airline for all people. It was premium leisure airline that offered you more legroom throughout coach, a better experience, branded snacks, TV, later internet. It wasn't designed to be the airline that everyone could fly all the time. And it's okay to do that, but I've always thought that airlines should play to their strength. And even though, Brett, you and I don't fly JetBlue much because we live on the West Coast, people on the East Coast still have relatively warm and fuzzy idea of what the JetBlue brand stands for. And I feel like with every passing year, JetBlue gets away from that, right? So in the beginning, they shrink legroom a little bit. You can get away with that. But I think both you and I have written about the JetBlue basic economy product, which is quite punitive, right? It doesn't compare with Delta's product. It doesn't compare with Americans. It does compare with United's a little bit, but those two airlines don't compete that closely together. You can't bring a large carry-on bag on JetBlue. So, okay, fine. What's the big deal? But if they're carrying themselves as a better experience for travelers, you kind of muddy what the brand stands for if you start not allowing customers to do certain things, and you start getting rid of these brand attributes one by one by one.
I agree with this. I do think, though, in the beginning, it was really about marketing. They were never just a premium airline. I mean, they came in, took all the slots at JFK, and it was fly a legacy or fly JetBlue. There was no ULCC presence or anything in the market, right? So it was a marketing thing. It was, hey, we've got the TVs, and they made them free. And that was David's, you know, Neeleman's thing. He could hang his hat on as a huge differentiator. And it worked. It was great. But in the end, they were also readily available for anyone who wanted a less expensive experience than flying on the legacies, because that was just the makeup of the market 25 years ago. But, you know, I think the part that I find so strange is you talk about basic economy, and you're right about this. It's about who you're competing with. You're in Boston, you're in New York. Delta is your biggest competition from a legacy carrier in these places, and you are not competitive. You have a worse basic economy product. Why? Because you're just trying to figure out how to get people to pay up to go to a higher level. I also think you talk about how they shrank legroom. They didn't really shrink legroom. They reduced pitch, but they used thinner seats. And again, this is like you try to market this and they failed. It just didn't work well. And, you know, maybe part of the issue is it took them 10 years to refit their A320s in the first place, and they're still not done. They still have like a dozen of the planes in the old configuration, which is insane to me that they're just totally fine with that. But, you know, they talk about wanting to be premium leisure, and you talk about humanity and, you know, all the things they've done over the years. And it kind of drives me insane, because then in the same breath, they say, well, now we have preferred seating we're going to charge you for, which is what people hate. It's just sitting closer to the front of the plane. And so they're really torn between this, let's create a better product and let's do a money grab because we're underperforming. So it's a very mixed message. I think they need to untangle this thing and figure out how they're going to do that and figure out how to actually be competitive with the products they offer. It's very strange to me.
It is very strange. But Brett, I have some pretty exciting news. John Ostrower, our third co-host, is actually around.
Who's this guy?
He is ready to join us. He wants to talk to us a little bit about JetBlue's fleet. So he's on the road, but we're going to speak to him. While we get ready, let's quickly talk about our sponsor, Intelsat.
So last week, we talked about in-flight internet from Intelsat and how it was going to replace the not too distant history of fax machines on Aerolíneas Argentinas. Some of you remember those days. I got some email about that.
Brett, I have to say, I literally didn't believe you. I've never heard of such a thing, but it's amazing that those things existed. And someday we're going to have to talk about Aerolíneas, but not today.
No, this is true. What we should be talking about is Intelsat, and what a remarkable upgrade this is going to be versus a fax machine. So Aerolíneas, of course, you know, flying way down south in the southern hemisphere, but also it's the polar routes in the northern hemisphere where you get a lot more traffic. And you think about some of the airlines that are getting this. Air Canada, they've got that Vancouver-Dubai route now. Going to need that going over the pole. American, a lot of those flights that really will benefit from having Wi-Fi going the entire route. Intelsat has that now with its geosynchronous and low Earth orbit combination with the one little tiny antenna, the 3-inch antenna. That's all you need.
Brett, you're absolutely certain that this is going to work almost everywhere in the world because people know I have to be able to download our podcast. I have to use Instagram. I have to write the Airline Observer. I can't be out of touch.
It's true. In fact, I heard that you canceled a trip this week because you weren't sure that you were going to have Wi-Fi. Is that correct?
That was one of the many reasons, yes.
One of the many reasons. Well, look, Intelsat has been testing this above the Arctic Circle. It works, and it's coming soon. This year, installs are going to start. Alaska, Air Canada, American, and of course, Aerolíneas Argentinas.
Can't wait to try it.
Staying connected anytime, anywhere is more important than ever. Intelsat leads the way with a multi-orbit network and industry-leading antenna technology that delivers nonstop in-flight connectivity everywhere airlines fly.
Brett, we have John here. I've been told that he's actually been listening to the end of the show. You and I, of course, we're California-based. John is Seattle-based, and he has some thoughts about what JetBlue could have done differently based on his Seattle experience.
All right, John, let's hear it.
Well, okay, so it's worth stepping back from a geographical position. We're spending a lot of time talking about Boston and New York and places where I grew up, so I know the area well. But I think when we talk about Delta coming in and trying to take Boston, we've seen this before. We saw it in Seattle. The fight for Seattle, the battle for Seattle between Alaska and Delta has been one of the more epic competitions that this industry has seen in the last 10 years. And effectively, Alaska fought, and Alaska stepped up its game. They matched them on premium. They matched them on the basic economy side, really at all points through the product offering. And what we saw was literally a strategy in the exact opposite for Boston. And where JetBlue was sent, saying, okay, we're going to go to Europe, which was, again, an extension of a New York and Boston strategy as another spoke, but I think it took on an outsized importance within JetBlue. But again, as the fight for Seattle took place, I mean, it would have been the equivalent of Alaska deciding that they were going to have a strategy to fly to, whether it was Europe itself or Mexico or somewhere outside of its core business that was really just getting people from the Pacific Northwest and the West Coast up and down and, you know, left and right. And I think that's where, you know, JetBlue lost its focus when Delta came to town.
Yeah, I agree with this completely, but let's not, we have you here for a reason, John. Let's talk fleet. Metal. You love metal. Let's talk about metal, because JetBlue does have some issues here. We still have Embraers flying around. We've got the 220s, we got the Neos, the LRs, you know, what, talk about fleet.
Yeah, it's a fleet that has been in transition for a while. You know, you go back to the first 320s that came in, you know, in 2001, 2002, and to the point where David Neeleman wanted E190s for as regional feed in and out of, you know, up and down all over the place. I mean, they were putting them everywhere, but they turned out to be actually very expensive airplanes on a kind of maintenance basis with the engines and other aspects. And then you get to the 220 deal, which at the time was the first order that Airbus formally received for the 220, literally a couple days after the deal between Bombardier and Airbus closed to bring the C-Series into Airbus as an Airbus product. So you take that, and then you take the 321 Neos, and then you 321 LRs, which, by the way, is a different configuration, in terms of, you know, how they're operating. So that adds an additional level of complexity. And then on top of that, you add in the challenges around the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan or durability issues that have really hit the industry. It's not unique to JetBlue, of course. But certainly when you add that level of complexity in and the durability issues on both the 220 and the 321neo, which on which they are relying for their next generation aircraft, it makes it really, really challenging to run an operation that is predictable in terms of the number of airplanes that you have. So I think what we see now is, you know, in terms of rationalizing the size of their fleet, where do those airplanes go? A lot of 321s, they just deferred. Well, that's probably going to make up a very large part of any deal that United does on the 321neo in lieu of the availability of the MAX 10. You know, almost probably Spirit has some airplanes in that mix as well when a deal is finally done, some lessors, all the different pieces that Airbus is trying to do to cobble together a significant deal for United. But within that, I think what it tells us is that those same airplanes that they were originally going to have in their fleet, they're probably going to be competing against in some respects in terms of where those airplanes end up. I mean, look, the United strategy for a large narrow body was to fly Boston, New York to the West Coast in premium configurations. This is like the airplanes that may have been and actually have a mint configuration or next generation mint configuration are going to be in a United PS configuration, possibly competing against them in their own backyard. And that is a very weird dynamic that they're going to have to rationalize when you think about where these airplanes go. Yes, you know, Joanna and Marty are trying to figure out, you know, okay, let's fly where people want to go. Let's fly where we make money. Those are all very good ideas when you're in the airline industry. But obviously the competitive dynamics are such that those airplanes that they would have had in terms of an environment where metal is scarce, whether it's in the US or wherever, then use having effectively giving up those positions to only have to compete with those same airplanes later on down the road.
See, here's where I'm a little stuck. I mean, some of this stuff is low-hanging fruit, right? Like, they have three aircraft types in the fleet, 320, 321, E90, and 220. And you have, what, seven different configurations? You've got three A321s. You have the LR. You have the Mint Neo or the Mint 321. And then you have the non-mint, the core one. And then you still have the two A320 configurations because they just haven't finished doing it. Then you've got the 220, the Embraer. Seems to me, you know, everyone says you can't shrink to profitability, but if you get rid of the Embraers, that has to help because those things are pigs on anything over like, what, an hour and a half or something like that. I mean, every time you see those things flying like New York, Florida, oh my God. And then, you know, get the configuration right. 321s, whatever, they're going to have those configuration differences, I guess. But then once you get that down, then how do you start growing again? I guess the announcement this week, they pulled out of a lot of the South American flying. Bogota, Quito, Lima, those are gone, which that's a way to get a lot of aircraft time back. So I get that, but presumably also underperforming. But, you know, if you're really willing to give up all these airplanes, then what's your business?
I think that comes back to the Alaska question again, right? There's a certain scale of an airline where it makes sense. Again, let's set aside the strategic risk of relying on a single supplier, which we've seen play out, whether on the engine side or on the airframe side. But if there is a certain size of an airline that can really benefit from a lack of fleet complexity. I mean, Alaska has resisted the urge to put lie-flats for east-west routes. I mean, look, I can close my eyes and I can, the Alaska LOPA is like, it's universal all across the 37s. And so that just gives them a degree of managing the complexity in a way that allows them to, I think, have more flexibility than they otherwise would had they gone to more of a segmented strategy. I mean, again, it's the contrasts are very, very important because I think what we see is Alaska had four fleet types. You know, the proudly all Boeing, right? They had the Virgin 320 COs, they had the Virgin 321 NEOs, which just left last September. They have the 737 NGs and MAXs. Before that, they had the Q400 turboprops at Horizon and the E175s. And now there are a two airplane type family. So the E175 and the 737 MAX NG fleet. I think the reality is that for the size that JetBlue is, they were running an operation that became overly complex. And there is a certain threshold at which, you know, if you're Delta and you have a tech ops organization and you have the ability to merge a Delta and Northwest and have, you know, DC-9s, A330s, 767s, 777-200LRs all flying together, you know, under one banner with like 17 different aircraft types all over the world, all over the country. Yeah, I think you can make it work. But they also had the revenue and the revenue premium to pay for that. You can't be a low-cost carrier and have the complexity side by side with it. You kind of have to pick one. And Delta, to its credit, understood that to achieve the reliability that you needed with this massively complex fleet of merging these two airlines together, that you're going to have to pay for it. You can't just run a low-cost operation with a fleet like that. And so you saw major investments in tech ops and really investing in making sure those airplanes were up to snuff for the kind of network and reliability they wanted. And for years, I mean, how long did they beat the drum on, you know, we have no cancellations. Yes, the delay was 11 hours, but we didn't cancel, you know, but they achieved that, right? That was part of who they were and how they thought about operations. So again, managing complexity, managing an airline, managing an aircraft fleet is all about what this is about. And fundamentally, I think JetBlue is at a point where they're trying to manage the complexity and reduce it and simplify it to a point where they can deploy their fleet and, you know, make money where people want to fly.
All right. Well, John, thank you for dropping in here in the middle of your event. Now, please go back to your adoring public.
That was fantastic. Thank you for that.
So, Brian, I, before we wrap this up, I want to take one of the things that John said about complexity here, because I know there is an area here that we disagree on, which is this whole vacation packages, travel products extension, which, you know, the argument can be made this adds complexity. It's taking away from the core business. But I disagree with that. I think there's actually value in doing it. So let's go. What do you think?
Yeah. JetBlue has a couple of ancillary businesses that I think make sense on paper, but also are very complex, and they add to the complexity of the airline. So one of them is this idea that got a lot of buzz, I don't know, 8 years ago or so, JetBlue Tech Ventures in Silicon Valley. They were going to invest in technology companies that not only would make a return for the airline, but would also help the airline run more smoothly, right? So whatever you would invest in would be good technology for a modern airline. I think that that's gone fine. It's gotten a lot of buzz, but I feel like you have to earn the right to have a side business like that. I got into a lot of trouble with my co-host last week for bringing up Scott Kirby as the paragon of what an airline executive should be.
Glad we got that mention in this week.
Scott Kirby came in 2016 at United as president, and the first thing that he did was talk about the revenue management system, Gemini, and it didn't work. And the second thing was the network is terrible. And only 4 or 5 years later did United say, we're going to do a tech ventures fund of our own. It wasn't the first thing that they did. And I felt like JetBlue, I still feel like JetBlue needs to fix the airline and stop worrying about these side projects like tech ventures. I think you're mostly in agreement with me there, Brett. The thing that we seem to disagree with a little bit is that JetBlue also has a subsidiary for what they call JetBlue Travel Products. And mainly that's the vacations business. But I've also noted if you go to their website, you can actually buy luggage on the website. And to me, you're running an airline. It's an airline that's not in the best shape. It's an airline that's lost focus, that is in bad shape, especially in a hub like Boston. And again, I think you have to earn the right to have an ancillary business like that. And even if it's going to make some money on the side, and even if Joanna Garrity spends, I don't know, you know, 1 minute a year on tech products, I just think that everybody should be on the same page, and it should be about network and revenue and fleet. And once everything is in order, then you can go back and have these various subsidiaries.
So I would argue, I mean, there are two different pieces here. Tech ventures, yes, go away. There's no, I don't think that they've demonstrated the need for that. They can talk about it and, you know, try and fluff it up as being this great thing, and they're doing things for humanity and the greatness of the world and climate. But that's a distraction that doesn't add to the core business. I mean, maybe eventually someday it creates something that is useful, but it's just not worth that effort. The travel product side is different. And to be honest, I don't fully understand it. They got this weird Paisley thing, and I don't really understand how it's all structured. But if you want to be a premium leisure airline, then being able to sell land products to people who want to do it through you, even if it's not that many people, which it may very well not be, that is core to the business in a sense, in that you're offering those people an easier way to create their entire vacation if that's what they want. If I remember right, it's based down in Orlando, right? So it's not even in New York. They kind of just keep it down there where no one can see it or pay attention to it. I assume it probably can run pretty much on its own. I don't know why they're selling luggage. That is strange. But you know, the idea of having these add-on packages that can make money and can be a value add for the customer you're trying to target, I think makes sense. This is not going to be an Allegiant-style success of, you know, integrating your packaging. But if it adds to the bottom line, then maybe they can stop charging for preferred seating. All right. So before we wrap up, let's just summarize this. How are we feeling right now about JetBlue? I would say I'm feeling very positive about the direction. It's early days. The network changes this week made a ton of sense. Very glad to see it. There's so much more. We obviously have to wait until May. They have the investor day when we should know a lot more about the plan. But in general, finally, for the first time in a long time, seeing something out of JetBlue that I actually think makes sense.
Yeah, I think that they've stemmed the bleeding. I think that they're on the upswing. But I also think that the things that Robin Hayes was trying to do, even though they didn't work and they ended up being a disaster, you know, once JetBlue is in better shape in a year or two or three, they still will be a niche airline only flying on the East Coast, undersized, and eventually they're going to have to figure out the size and scale problem.
We're far from that, I think. Yeah. Maybe someday that'll be a good problem for them to have. But let's, all right, let's wrap it there. You've been listening to The Air Show, and once again, thanks for following the show and welcoming it into your podcast feeds. We could use your help to spread the word about the show. Please recommend the podcast to your colleagues and anyone else in the industry who might have missed our announcement last week.
If you have suggestions or questions for us, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, go to our website, theairshowpodcast.com, to get in touch.
And thanks to Intelsat for sponsoring the show. The Air Show podcast is produced and edited by Sarah Fay. Our theme music is by Joshua Mosier. Jennifer Swadek mixed this episode. I'm Brett Snyder.
I'm Brian Summers. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.